I'm Pandey Sujata, and this is a class on the Satipatthana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 10, the discourse on mindfulness meditation. Okay, so let us begin. This is what I heard, first line of the sutta. So what I will do is give a bit of an explanation and background as to what this is all about and what it is in fact that we have heard and why we've heard it and why it matters. Now, in the Buddhist tradition, they'll tell you that the last I've heard is the words of Venerable Ananda, who heard the suttas from the Buddha. But that's not correct. The words last I've heard are a special oral idiom, which mean that this is something that I was not present at, but that I heard about. Okay? There's another idiom that you use if you want to say, this is something that I heard because I was there. Okay, so this is specifically and solely used to mean that I wasn't there, but I heard that this was happening. Okay, in other words, what this little statement at the beginning is announcing is it's announcing that this is something which has been passed down through an oral tradition. Okay, that's a little sort of line at the beginning saying this is what's happening here. We're talking about an oral tradition. So what is this oral tradition? Where does it come from? Well, when the Buddha was teaching in India 2,500 years ago. Now, try and cast your mind back to a day in the long past before there was Twitter, before there was Facebook, before there was even email. Yes, there was a time before email. And before computers were invented, before even books were invented. Before even manuscripts were invented, and we come to the time of the Buddha. Now, it's not entirely clear whether writing existed in the time of the Buddha, but the very fact that it's not entirely clear tells us that if it did exist, it wasn't all that important. The main means that information was passed down from one generation to the next was by memory. Okay, so it's what we call the oral tradition, reciting and memorizing texts and passing them down. Now, when we're brought up in an age where we've been conditioned by 2,500 years of literate culture, especially in the Western tradition, or 2,000 years of literate culture if we're in the Indian tradition, I guess more than 2,500 years if we're in the Chinese tradition, but anyway, long time, we think that that's the only reliable way to pass down information, and we think that memory is very unreliable, and that's something we've believed ever since we were at school and we tried to smuggle cheat notes into our exams because we thought it's more reliable to write things down than it is to put them in our memory. Okay? However, that's not necessarily the case. And in fact, any way of preserving and passing down information is subject to corruption and subject to faults. There's no perfect way of transferring or preserving information. And there's no indication that the oral tradition is any less reliable than the written tradition. How do we know this? We know this, the best piece of evidence for this is not the Buddhist text, but is in fact a Hindu text called the Rig Veda. And a Rig Veda is a collection of ancient scriptures which was compiled in ancient India a long, long time ago, many, many hundreds of years before the Buddha, probably about 1000 BC or so. We don't know the exact date, but what we do know from linguistic studies is that the linguistic forms in the Rig Veda are extremely archaic. And this is something that linguists can analyze to quite a degree of precision. So we know that the linguistic forms preserved in the Rig Veda are very, very archaic. And anybody who was even at the time of the Buddha who was hearing those words would know that they were archaic, they were very ancient. It would be like if you were to listen to somebody speaking Shakespeare today, you'd know immediately without a shadow of a doubt that this is very old language. And so the Rig Veda was passed down in the oral tradition for at least 1,000 years, probably a lot longer, probably more like 2,000 years or even longer. It's not entirely sure when it was first written down or when they stopped relying on the oral tradition, but it certainly was in the thousands rather than hundreds of years. How did they do this? Right? Well, they developed a very advanced science or technique of training themselves to be able to memorize text exactly. And there's a big difference between a training specifically to memorize something literally letter by letter, okay, and the way that we normally use memory. It actually uses quite different structures in your brain and so on. And what they would do is they'd memorize each line forwards, and they'd also memorize each line backwards, okay, letter by letter. So you can imagine like thousands of verses of poetry reciting it literally backwards, letter by letter, and forwards. And all of these different kinds of tricks that they would use to remember them so that they would force themselves to be able to know it exactly every letter. And then, of course, they would do it in groups. They would have different branches memorizing different bits, and they would memorize it, and they'd come back together. And so they had many different ways of checking the information as well. So this was the culture that the Buddha appeared in. This way of doing this thing was already very highly developed when the Buddha was there, and this was just considered natural in the culture, that if you wanted to preserve a body of scripture, a body of text, that's how you did it. So when the Buddhist Sangha began to form, the Buddha began to give teachings, then he, first thing to understand is that the Buddha would have expected that his students would memorize his teachings. Okay? So he would shape his teachings in a way that made them easy to memorize. Okay? And you do that by, for example, using repetition. You do that by using verses, which are much more memorable. So like songs are more memorable than prose texts, so verses are more memorable. And so there are many different kinds of literary techniques which are used in order to aid the memorization of the texts. They would have been used right from the beginning, and over time their use would have been multiplied and amplified. And so that the Buddhist community would have been remembering these texts from the earliest days. And this Buddhist community was, of course, what we call the fourfold community. The bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen, and lay women. Okay, and it's very clear from the Buddhist texts themselves that all parts of that community were participating in the memorizing of the texts. Even though at a later time it became basically just the monks doing it, but certainly in the earliest days it was all parts of the tradition. In fact, there's a tradition about one of the books in the Pali Canon, Iwuttaka, that apparently the monks forgot it and they had to go and learn it from a group of laywomen who were the only people who remembered that particular text. So that would have probably been a bit embarrassing for the monks. But anyway, they went and did it, and they had to go and learn this whole scripture from this group of laywomen who had memorized it. Now imagine what was happening in those days, right? And you didn't have libraries, right? You didn't have like a centralized resource. You didn't have instant communications and all of those things. What you had was people were wandering, especially the monks and nuns, were wandering around from place to place. Okay, so the Buddha would go from one town to another, from one city to another, and he would give teachings in different places. Sometimes the same people would be at the teaching, sometimes it would be different people, right? And he'd be teaching sometimes for specific individuals, sometimes for the community as a whole, and so on. And so he would, of course, as any teacher does, he would keep returning to the same themes again and again and again. And so you'd find many different talks on the same topic, right? Sometimes very similar ones, maybe just a little bit different in one place than the other. And these were then memorized. But you can imagine that, you know, one monk, for example, might memorize a text in one town, and then they might meet up with another monk who'd memorize the text in another town, and then they might recite together, and they're like, oh, actually, it's a bit different, but it's mostly the same, right? Because, well, maybe the Buddha taught it a bit differently in those two places, and so on. So there's always been this kind of a degree of variation and adaptation in the text from the earliest times. But the texts are built around what the linguist or text critical analysts call pericopes, which is like the short passages, standardized passages, which were repeated again and again and again. And it's those pericopes which contain the core doctrinal teachings of the Buddha, and we'll be discussing one of those a little bit later in this sutta itself, dealing with practice of mindfulness. So, this floating mass of texts, and to cut a very long story down a little bit shorter, after the Buddha passed away, the Sangha got together, recited these texts, and sort of organized them into different collections. And those collections were passed down initially in the oral tradition, and then later on the tradition was written down. It was written down first in Sri Lanka, as far as we know, around 20 BC. Presumably other collections were being written down on the mainland around the same time, but we don't have a historical record for that. Today they've been passed down in different collections. The text that we're looking at now is from the Pali collection, passed down primarily in Sri Lanka. The exact Pali text that this was based on is an edition called the Mahasangiti edition, which was edited by a Thai group based on a Burmese manuscript. So this is essentially a Burmese text. When I say Burmese, like a Pali text, but as in the Burmese recension. Each of them have very, very minor differences between them, but this is essentially a Burmese version. Different strands of the Buddhist traditions preserved the early texts in their own way, and all of them had some differences but were mostly similar. And one of the things that's done in modern scholarship is to look at these different branches of the Buddhist texts and to compare them, as well as the Pali tradition from Sri Lanka, which is the most important one because it's preserved in the original Indic language, okay? So the Pali language is something which is very close to what the Buddha spoke, okay? It's a dialect of what the Buddha spoke. Same texts are also passed down, translated into Chinese, or very similar texts, but translated into Chinese, and we have a very large body of scriptures basically very, very similar to what we have in the Pali canon, but in Chinese translations. And there's a much smaller group of early texts also in Tibetan, and some also in Sanskrit. Typically, when we talk about Buddhist scriptures or Buddhist suttas, when we're talking about the early Buddhist texts, usually we focus mainly on the Pali tradition. That's the most well known, it's the most accessible, and the texts are the easiest and most reliable to read on the whole. But that doesn't mean that they're always perfect, and it's always useful to look at the versions available from the other traditions whenever possible. So a number of years ago I did a lengthy study of the Satipatthana Sutta, called A History of Mindfulness, and if you're interested to look at this in more detail, then you can get hold of that book, A History of Mindfulness, and I go into quite some detail there into all of the different versions. I think about six or seven different versions of the material in Satipatthana, and study that on a comparative basis, and I'll be talking more about the results of that study as we go on. Okay, so so that's a brief background as to how this text started out from the Buddha or from the early Buddhist community and ended up in our hands here today. And before I go on, any questions on that process? Yeah, you can. I mentioned that the text that we're using here, or that the Pali text on which this translation is based, is an edition called the Mahasangiti edition, and that was an edition compiled by a Thai group called the Dhamma Society about 10 years ago. What happened was that when they had in the 1950s, they had a big council to celebrate the Buddha's 2500th anniversary, and they had a big recitation of the Pali text that's called the Sixth Council, or the Chattasangiti. And the Sixth Council was supposedly to bring together the sanghas from all of the different traditions and to come up with a master edition that would be a sort of a globally accepted edition of the Pali canon. And that was presided over, the chief questioner at the council was the well-known monk Mahasi Sayadaw. That's not exactly what happened at the council, though. What essentially happened at the council was that they redacted a Burmese edition. Okay, so the sixth council edition is essentially the Burmese text. I've heard this from a monk who was there. There's a Sri Lankan monk, Dhammavihari, he's passed away now, but he was present there. He said that basically the Thai monks went off into one corner and did their text, and the Sri Lankan monks went in their corner and did their text, and the Burmese were running the show, so they did their text, and that's the sixth council edition. So anyway, that's what we have. Like I said before, the differences between them are almost all very minor. Actually, Satipatthana Sutra is an exception to that, and there are major differences between the recensions, and I'll talk about them later on. But generally speaking, the differences are very minor. When the council was finished, they then published that, and in Burma, and most of the modern digital editions that exist today have been based on that published edition of the Sixth Council. Okay, the best known one is the one which is created by the Goenka tradition, and they published that on their website many years ago. And the Thai group, the Dhamma Society, took that text, so it's based on the Goenka text, and they then thoroughly proofread it and corrected it against about 12 different textual sources to do corrections against. So of all the digital texts that's been created, the Mahasangita is by far the best proofread and the most accurate. Yeah, so that's the one we'd be used on my website on Sutta Central. Yeah. Okay. So this particular sutta, any other questions before we go on? Okay, so this particular sutta is one of the best studied and best known suttas in the whole of the Pali canon. And unfortunately, it's become, in a way, very politicized, and there's a lot of ideology which sort of swirls around this particular text. And that sometimes obscures what the thing is actually saying, which is a bit unfortunate. In the Buddhist traditions, especially in the Sri Lankan tradition, it was always regarded as an especially sacred text, and was often found in the home, like it was considered very meritorious to copy this particular text, and they would sponsor it, and they'd often have it in homes, maybe read it out at special occasions and things like that. And it was one of the first texts which was, because of that reason, it was one of the first ones that was really encountered and looked at by the English when they were in Sri Lanka, and they started to actually learn Pali and have a look, rather than simply trying to, you know, dismissing Buddhism as just pagan idol worship and primitive superstitions. Okay, and they actually picked up one of these texts and started to read it. And you can imagine the surprise of the poor old English gentleman who were, you know, used to reading the Bible or something like that, and they're picking up and they think, oh, this must be a very sacred text. And they read it and they're like, well, hang on, where's all the God stuff? I can't see any God things in here. Because what do you think? I know that I'm breathing in and I'm breathing out. What is this, you know? And then you go a little bit, about going to the toilet? You say, what? You know, it's all a bit weird, right? And then all of this kind of stuff. I know what I'm feeling, and I know I'm English. I don't have feelings. And so it's all kind of, you know, it was very difficult to get your head around what actually is this all about, right? It's a very different kind of spiritual text compared to what you might be used to if you come from a theistic background, right? You know, just to reflect about that, you know, there's no, it's quite an extraordinary thing, you know, to have a text that just goes straight to talking about experience, right? That's all, right? And all of the kind of theology and the cosmology and all of the rituals and all of the things that we normally surround religion with are just ignored, right? They're just not relevant. And it just goes straight to how do you look at your own experience and understand your own experience. And so for that reason, it's a very kind of powerful text. Now, the Satipatthana Sutra in modern times, in the 20th century, was used as the basis for the most of the 20th century meditation schools, particularly those originated in Burma, and especially the most famous ones, of course, are the Goenka tradition and the Mahasi tradition, both of which sort of claim the Satipatthana Sutta as their kind of root texts. And even outside of those traditions, it's still very influential. When I did my detailed study of this, I'd begun my practice of Buddhist practice in the Mahasi tradition, and so I did a sort of detailed study of this sutta shortly after I arrived at the monastery. And I read a number of books and studied studies of it. I memorized the sutta in English and in Pali, and so you know it was always a sort of quite a major part of my own practice for a long time. But as I proceeded in my understanding and study of Dhamma grew, I began to realize that there were a number of quite critical problems with the sort of received interpretation of the text, and so I began to look more deeply, and that's why I began the research, which ended up with a history of mindfulness. So when we go through the text, I don't want to delve too deeply into the text critical things at the beginning, and possibly even not as we go on. I don't think it's the right place to do it in too much detail. But we will be referring to some things in passing because I think that they do have some practical implications. And I'll just mention right at the beginning a few things. How many things? One, two, things. What's the third one? Sorry, I'm just going through my mind the different aspects, thinking which ones I should mention right up front. Okay, I'll mention. There's three things in particular which I think are a bit problematic about this particular text, and which I think it's good to know some background before reading it. I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. Okay. After doing the comparative study of the text, the conclusion that I came to was that Satipatthana Sutta, in the form that we have it today, is one of the latest texts in the Pali Canon, and in fact was probably compiled in Sri Lanka about 300 years after the death of the Buddha. Now there are complicated reasons for that, which I won't go into right now. The flip side of that, though, is that when I say it was compiled at such a late date, it doesn't mean it was invented at such a late date, right? It means that all the different bits were put together in the form that we have it today at that late date. The main reason for saying that is because the versions that we have in Chinese are substantially different, okay? The bits are there from the early period, but they've been organized in a different way. And what I think is happening, what I think the Satipatthana Sutta is the earliest or one of the earliest attempts to do like a compilation of all of the major meditation methods, to bring them all under one umbrella, a bit like a sort of a greatest hits album, right? So it's like the Buddha's greatest hits, okay? Right, so when you have a... right, so if you have like the Buddha's greatest hits, it doesn't mean that, you know, the Buddha did, you know, if they have a greatest hits album of an artist, it doesn't mean that they didn't actually sing those songs, but the compilation was made at a somewhat later date than the original things, okay? So that's fine, but there were certain things about the way that it was arranged, which either deliberately or not, I'm not quite sure, but created a certain impression or gave a certain emphasis to the text which may not have been there from the beginning. Okay? So there probably was a Satipatthana Sutta from the earliest times, and it probably did contain many of the things that we have today, but other things have been put in there as well. Okay? Now the main things which are different, and which I'll mention at the beginning, number one is the sections on being aware of your postures. Okay? Being mindful of your postures and your movements. These are almost certainly a later interpolation, and the reason for that is because these practices are found very, very commonly throughout the Buddhist texts, in dozens if not hundreds of other places, and every single time that they occur elsewhere, they always occur as a practice which is a way of preparing yourself for meditation. Okay? They're what you do before you start to sit and meditate. And there's nowhere else where they occur actually after doing breath meditation and as a meditation itself. Okay? So you can see that that makes actually quite a large difference. Okay? There's a big difference from saying something is a practice that's good to prepare yourself for meditation and something which actually can replace meditation. Right? And this is what you hear sometimes people saying today, you don't need to meditate. The Satipatthana Sutta says, you can just be mindful in whatever you do. Right? Therefore you don't have to meditate. Well actually, no, that's not really what it's saying. Okay? If you look at the Buddhist texts overall, they're clearly saying that these things, of course they're good to do, of course they're important, and of course they're part of our practice, but they are part of our practice to prepare for meditation. They were never meant to be replacing doing sitting meditation. So this is one of the things which I think is unfortunate. Second thing is, I had in the back of my mind that I've forgotten, I had a list of three things I thought of earlier today, and in the back of my mind that I've forgotten one of them. But anyway, second thing is that in the section under Dhammanupassana, the fourth of the four Satipatthanas, we have things like the aggregates, the senses and things like that. These are almost certainly later additions, and originally the practice of Dhammanupassana, if I've translated as the observation of principles, would have consisted of the five hindrances and the seven awakening factors. Okay? And there are very strong text critical reasons for thinking that that's the case. What the implications of that are, we might look at more closely later on. But then the third one, and probably the most important one, is that what was certainly a later addition is the passage on the observation of origination and dissolution, or rise and fall, okay, or origination and cessation, which we find mentioned after every passage. And that passage is not found in any other version, pretty much. There's a few little complications to that, but basically it's pretty much not found in any other version. And that makes a big difference in how the sutta is interpreted. You probably have heard in the sort of traditional way of presenting Satipatthana in the 20th century is that Satipatthana is vipassana. You may be surprised to know that there's nowhere in the early Buddhist text where it says that Satipatthana is vipassana. And in fact, there's no other text apart from this one that closely associates Satipatthana and vipassana. Okay? So what is going on here? Well, to come back, we'll explain what is samatha and what is vipassana. Okay? Two aspects of Buddhist meditation. The samatha, tranquility, vipassana, insight or discernment. Okay? Buddhists in the suttas, in the early Buddhist texts, are always encouraging us to develop both of these two things, right? So these are both things which are bhavedabha, to be developed. And when they're out of balance, then you need to balance them. If you don't have enough vipassana, you should develop that. If you don't have enough samatha, you should develop that. And there are many different meditations given for developing these two qualities of mind. Okay? Now through the suttas, the contemplation of vipassana, okay, of insight meditation, is very closely associated with the concepts of what we call the tilakana, the three characteristics, which hopefully you've all heard of, impermanence, suffering, and not self. Okay? And there are of course hundreds of suttas that teach this, okay? Hundreds of suttas that talk about contemplating impermanence and contemplating not self and suffering and so on. And they do this in all kinds of different ways, right? And in all of those hundreds of suttas talking about contemplation of impermanence, none of them talk about that in relation to Satipatthana, okay? So none of all of the hundreds of suttas in the Pali Canon actually make a connection between Vipassana and Satipatthana, with some exceptions, which I'll mention in a minute, but I'm just giving a general introduction, okay? Now, in the Satipatthana Sutta, it includes a refrain at the end of every meditation which says you should contemplate this in terms of rise and fall and impermanence and so on. And this is a passage which is almost certainly added at a later date. And because of that addition, it's always been said that Satipatthana is Vipassana. Okay? If you take that out, then you really don't have anything that connects or that says that Satipatthana is Vipassana practice at all. So what exactly is going on, and what difference does it make? Well, maybe it doesn't make any difference, I don't know, but if we look at what Satipatthana is in the context of the Eightfold Path, okay, always when we try to understand these basic teachings of the Buddha, we always want to look at them, how they appear in the main context, okay, not just in one sutta or another sutta, but how do they appear in the overall context of the path. And right mindfulness and Satipatthana is the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right? Seventh factor, just before right samadhi, sama samadhi. And in the suttas, in a number of different cases, it says that the reason for practicing Satipatthana is to lead to samadhi, okay, is to lead to stillness of mind. And that obviously is what samatha is about, okay? So we practice Satipatthana in order to realize that peace of mind. In the Eightfold Path, Satipatthana, So that's the purpose of Satipatthana, is to lead to samadhi, lead to jhanas. There is, having said all that, there is an aspect of Satipatthana which is talking about vipassana and insight. They're not entirely separate, so please don't mistake me. I'm not trying to say that they're entirely separate. I'm trying to say that the main emphasis of Satipatthana practice is on grounding your mind, centering your mind, and being a basis for samadhi, okay? As that practice matures and deepens, then there is a development of insight as well, and that in the sutta is what's happening under the Dhammanupassana, the observation of principles, the fourth of the four Satipatthanas. And that's where we find the practice of Vipassana emerging. It's something that emerges from the passage of the practice of Satipatthana. So it's included there, it's an aspect of it, but it's not the whole thing. And so I think it's unfortunate that the Satipatthana Sutra has become so sort of central, and that its teachings have often been taught out of context of the meditations that are taught much more widely throughout the Pali Canon. Oh, I just remembered the thing that I'd forgotten before. I have forgotten something. Okay, so I've mentioned three things so far which the Satipatthana Sutta does differently to everywhere else. It includes the practices of mindfulness of your postures as a meditation rather than a preparation for meditation. It's added the extra practices to the Dhammanupassana, the observation of principles. It's emphasized the Vipassana rather than Samatha. And the other thing which is very important, it has a very, very different take on feelings than you find in the rest of the suttas, okay? If you look at the rest of the suttas, in hundreds of cases, the practice of meditation is closely associated with pleasure, okay? Countless times, in fact, the word pleasure or sukha is sometimes even a synonym for meditation in the suttas, right? The word sukha, if you say I'm abiding in pleasure, that means that you're sitting in meditation, okay? And there's so many words associated with pleasure, rapture, happiness, joy, uplift. All of these words are associated with meditation in almost every time that meditation is taught in the suttas. In the Satipatthana Sutta, it has a slightly different angle. It's stepping back from those feelings and it's looking at them much more objectively. And so it's treating pleasure, feeling, painful feeling, neutral feeling as somehow equal, right? It's not saying one is better than the other, right? And so this is another aspect of the sutta which is quite distinct from everywhere, from almost every other sutta or meditation. So in that respect, it's not, again, none of these things is necessarily wrong. It's not a matter of being right or wrong. It's a matter of what's the emphasis, right? What's the perspective that you're getting on it, right? And so if you come to meditation, and in the modern tradition, as I found in my first retreat, that, you know, I was experiencing joy and rapture in my meditation, it was basically frowned on. It's like, oh, you know, you're going to get attached and you shouldn't be experiencing that and so on. I'm like, oh, what have I done wrong? I'm experiencing it. I'm happy, you know? And that's excessive, right? That's not what the suttas are saying. Actually, pleasure is something which needs to be developed through meditation, okay? So it's important that we don't just take one text and sort of replace everything else that the Buddha taught on meditation, okay? We need to look at what this text says in the context of the wider teachings of meditation which the Buddha gave. Yeah, right.
I was just thinking about the second time I met Goenkaji.
Oh.
He just said, be happy. So I'm just wondering if his emphasis on not being happy is coming from somewhere else.
Quite possibly, yeah. I don't know.
I mean, maybe not. He wasn't talking about when you're meditating. Right. It should be pleasure or anything like that. But I'm just wondering if there's another influence there.
Yeah, and he from my understanding, he did have a very kind of positive and joyful presence. Yeah. So from what I hear, yes, and I think it's something which the impression that I get is that it's something which is. Has become much more. I think that these teachings became much more dogmatic in lesser hands, and I think that they are not. Goenka's a little bit of a different situation because it's been taught by him through the videos in the retreat. But certainly in the Mahasi tradition, you know, it's been very much sort of popularized through, and so there's hundreds of monks who've been teaching the tradition and so on, and My suspicion is that I don't think that Mahasi himself was as, you know, as severe on these things as perhaps some of his students have been. That's the impression that I get. But I'm not familiar enough with the tradition to be able to say definitively. Yeah. Kate?
I think with a lot of people that follow that dogmatic approach. And I was wondering why that is, hard to understand why. Has it been working for them?
Well, it obviously works to some degree, right? I mean, it's not as if it's, you know, completely wrong or anything like that. But it's certainly been very successful. I mean, the reasons for why it's successful have been something that I've been talking about for a number of years, and it's actually become somewhat of a topic in academic circles recently, and there have been a number of more historical studies of this. Actually, a recent book came out called, what was it? Just came out, I just saw a review of it, I haven't read the book itself, but it's talking about how these 20th century forms of meditation replaced the traditional forms of meditation that were used in Theravada Buddhism, especially in Thailand. To cut a long story short, again, this is actually the short version, okay? To cut a long story short, remember that these were colonial times that these meditation techniques came up in, okay? The colonial powers have been all through Asia, and they've done their best to destroy all these religions, to dismiss them, they treated them with contempt, and they basically had said, this is a load of rubbish, and this is just superstitions, and this is magic, and this is all of this crap, okay? And, of course, the dirty secret is that they were largely right, okay? that most of the things that were actually being practiced were actually just superstitions and were actually just black magic and all of these kinds of things, okay? But of course there was a teaching underneath that which was had a lot of all of the wisdom and so on of the Buddha. It wasn't what was largely practiced, right? So that the Buddhist traditions around the end of the 19th century, mid to end of the 19th century, began the phase of developing what we call Buddhist modernism. Okay, and Buddhist modernism or modernisms are any form of Buddhism that you and I have encountered are modernist forms of Buddhism. And modernist forms of Buddhism are essentially what the Buddhist traditions did to reinvent themselves in the face of the critique made by the colonial powers. Okay, and Buddhist modernisms take on many forms, but one of the essential characteristics that they all have is that they're rational. Okay. So they came out swinging, right? They didn't just sit there and take it. They said, no, they said Buddhism is the rational religion, okay? We're not about God and all of these rituals. What is this wine into blood thing anyway, okay? And they came out and said, actually, this is about a perfectly rational psychology. It's about observing your mind states, understanding the nature of causality and so on. And so you have this very familiar modernist rhetoric. If you read a book like, say, What the Buddha Taught by Walpole Rahula, a sort of classic text of Buddhist modernism, but similar ideas were taught widely in Japan, Korea, Vietnam, everywhere across the Buddhist world, okay? Now, when that came to meditation circles, what they said was actually what was going on in a lot of the older meditations, okay? Older meditations, and if you're in Thailand, okay, I'll give you an example. What's a traditional meditation in Thailand? Well, I'll tell you a story from when I was staying in the very easternmost tip of Thailand, in a place called Phujongkom. And in Phujongkom is one of the most remote villages in the whole of Thailand, and one of the least reached by modernity. And on the river there's a little village called Kantakwen, which is just on the Mekong River overlooking Laos. And you know, when I was there, early 90s, they had one telephone in the village, right? I mean, it was the place where you know, modernity hadn't penetrated all that far. Now, in the local village, the village of Kantakwen, there was a monk called Ajahn Sungwon. And one of the monks once asked him, Ajahn, how long have you been staying here in this village? And he just looked at him and said, Loi Chet Sip Bi. And it's 170 years. Okay? And this Ajahn Sungwon was a very, very funny monk. And during the time that we were there, all kinds of adventures that we had, okay, with Ajahn Sungwon and his different contacts, and the kinds of things that went on, including things like smuggling weapons-grade plutonium through the monastery and so on. But you don't want to hear that story. Anyway, what was the thing? Oh, yes, meditation. Now, the story that I heard from one of the senior Western monks at the time was saying that he was sitting around with one of the other local monks, the Ajahn's, one of the local monasteries, and the other Ajahn had said, it'd be really good to be able to predict lottery numbers. And Ajahn Sungwon was like, oh yeah, it's not hard. He said, how do you do it? He said, okay, here's how you do it. So, they get a coconut, okay? And they put the coconut on the shrine, okay? And then Ajahn Sungwon comes along and then does his prostrations and things and does chanting for a long time and then sits meditation for a couple of hours, right? And he could really sit, right? Okay? You know, he used to come to our different ceremonies and things like that, and he would just like sit for hours, right? And so he would just sat with this coconut, and then he said, okay, now it's finished. And then when it's finished, they broke the coconut open, and they looked inside the flesh, inside the shell of the coconut, and they see like these indentations, which sort of looked like number shaped, okay? So then they could buy the lottery ticket, and apparently they won the lottery for those numbers, yeah? So there you go, that's how you do the whole lottery prediction thing, okay? So this is an example of what they call Buran Kamatan. It's an ancient style of meditation. There are many different ways that this was done, but a lot of them involved this kind of magical, almost tantric practices, which were very sort of frequent throughout that area. And so when in the 20th century, what they did, they came along and said, no, meditation isn't for putting the curses on people, it's not for predicting lottery numbers, it's not for developing magic and psychic abilities, it's not for all of those things, it's for a scientific understanding of your own mind and body, okay? And so what the emphasis very much was on a clinical and detached observation, okay? Emotions tended to be put to one side because emotions are messy and unscientific, okay? Especially those days. Yeah? These days in modern psychology, people have an understanding of the role that emotions play. But it's still an issue, right? I mean, if you've been following the news recently, there's this issue about, is it okay for women scientists to cry? Okay? You saw that thing that the scientist was, basically lost his job because he said, oh, you can't work with women scientists. They always, you know, they're always just crying all the time. And, right? But then the interesting thing that happened was that then a few days ago there was a climate change panel, and one of the scientists on there was became so emotional about what was happening that she cried. Okay, and it so happened she was a woman, right? And she was a scientist, and she was actually crying because of the tragedy of what's happening. And then, then that becomes an issue, right? Is that something that you could do anyway? So that relationship between emotion and reason has always been fraught in the West. So this is one of the ways that Vipassana meditation was made acceptable, was made modern, it was made rational, it was made scientific. Right? You divest the emotions out of it, and it's about a clinical observation of your mind and body. Yeah? And so that was very successful in the traditional Buddhist countries, and also became a very successful selling point for being able to import meditation to the West. Right? And we shouldn't underestimate how successful that's been. It's been incredibly successful. And that has been the basis that's then allowed the Western interpreters of that meditation, people like John Kabat-Zinn and others, to then apply it in psychology, psychotherapy, to take it into hospitals, take it into prisons, take it into schools and so on, and all of the things that we've seen today. Right? And that ability of us today to be able to take meditation into all of those environments, okay, began with this modernist reform. Okay? So don't underestimate how powerful and how influential it is. Okay, it's very, very important. And so when I'm saying that the text has been in some ways misinterpreted and so on, please don't understand that I'm not trying to sort of put this down or to belittle the achievement of the people who've done that. I'm just trying to say that it's not the whole story and that there's more to it. Yeah.
You're saying that the Satipatthana Sutta only achieves the iconic status through reform Buddhism, or was it iconic before that in Sri Lanka?
It seems to have been before that, as far as I can tell. I'm not exactly sure of the history, but certainly in the 19th century it seems to have been widely copied and distributed around homes in Sri Lanka, and I'm not sure how far back that tradition goes.
Just wondering why something that deals with an ultimate step of the path has achieved sort of iconic status compared to a sutta on Samadhi.
Right, exactly. Why that sutta rather than something like Samanyapala Sutta, for example, or there could be many others which have, and I'm sure that there's a rich tradition to that, where I don't know what that is. Mindfulness of the postures.
Okay. So is that just the postures, it's not referring to the other one? Like
that's right, yeah.
So in the Satipatthana and Vipassana, you're saying they have different emphasis, but do they have similar effects?
That's another question, Difficult to say, difficult to say. It probably depends more on the practitioner than anything else. Yeah. I mean, the reality is that most people don't do what their meditation teacher tells them to do anyway. Right? So, I think it does have different effects, and I think in some cases, I think the dry vipassana approach is not very useful. I think in many cases, obviously it is. But certainly, you know, one thing that, you know, we find as meditation teachers, and we've talked about this many times, is that there are certain kinds of problems that can come from too much of an emphasis on what they call like the dry vipassana approach. It can leave you. Sorry, I'll come back to you in a second. But it can leave your mind. It can be too much, you know. It can be like it's just too much dukkha. You're too exposed, and so like the samatha practice and the experience of the pleasure and so on. It gives you a way of easing into it. It's kind of a more balanced approach. So for some people, it seems to be okay. You know, just very kind of barely. You just look at everything, and that's just reality, and just deal with it. But a lot of people, they need a lot more of a cushioning into it. Yeah. Sorry.
So I'm not familiar with Vipassana, so I think a little bit more about what is it in summary, and then what's the difference in
the. Okay. So there's two kinds of meditation, samatha and vipassana. Samatha, tranquility, vipassana, insight. Okay? So when we're talking about vipassana, what we're really talking about is understanding impermanence. Okay? Understanding conditionality. Understanding suffering, understanding not self. Okay, so when you meditate, you look at, for example, and we'll look at different examples of how this works later on. So there are many different ways of doing it, but you might look, for example, at how your senses are impermanent. Right, you see something, and then a minute later you see something else, or a minute later you hear something, and these are quite separate. And so you're looking at how your experience is made up of all of these separate kinds of consciousness, kinds of awareness. And that these are always changing, okay? Whereas with samatha meditation, you tend to focus on something which is very peaceful and very soothing. So you maybe focus on the breath or something like that, and that tends to make your mind very peaceful. So that's a kind of generally a different approach. Yeah?
You were responding to the question about the popularity of these. Did you mention another one?
Oh, Samanipala Sutta? Yeah, Digha Nikaya number 2.
Okay.
It's a magnificent sutta in a number of different ways. But that presents what we call the gradual training. And the gradual training as a framework for meditation is the main framework for practicing a meditation found in the suttas. And Digha Nikaya 2 in the Pali Canon is the main source for that. Yeah. So I mean, that's also a very famous one in the Pali tradition, but it's not as iconic as the Samyutta Sutta. Okay. So I know this is all a bit heavy on the theory and so on, so don't worry if you don't get everything that we've been talking about so far. Mostly, you know, what I've been talking about, I guess, is mostly aimed at the more experienced meditators and so on. I think if you approach this particular sutta from a background of having been in the Vipassana traditions, you probably will have a lot of preconceptions about what we're going to be doing and how we're dealing with the text. And so I wanted to mention this up front so that you could sort of know that I'm approaching it from a somewhat different direction, that's all. But if there are things about what I'm talking about which you didn't understand or which didn't have enough context, don't worry about it too much. It will become clearer as we go on. Okay. Okay. Any other questions before we continue? Yeah, come on.
The issue about the
passage sort of refrain on origination.
Mm.
So when you watch things arise and pass away,
mm.
being later. And yet there's a little sutta in the Satipatthana Samhita which deals with origination.
Right.
My understanding from what she said previously is that the Samhita is very early. So that's got that little bit of origination.
Yeah.
So what's your understanding of why the Vedic Satipatthana Sutta?
Okay, so in the Satipatthana Samyutta, you find this idea of that treating Satipatthana in terms of rise and fall, I think in two suttas. Okay, so that's out of about 80 or so suttas, right? So it's obviously a very small part of it. So it's like I was saying, that there's not like this absolute difference between the Satipatthana and Vipassana. The relationship is there, but it's a very minor theme in those kind of shorter or earlier texts, and it was from there that it was taken and then appended in the end of each refrain in the Satipatthana Sutta. Okay, and so you can see it's not necessarily inventing something new, but it's shifting the emphasis quite a bit. As for why, I don't think that passage was part of the original one, because it's not in any of the other versions. Okay, so when we're talking about the other versions. That needs to be qualified a little bit, but when we talk about the other versions, we have another version of this in the Pali Abhidhamma, and it's very noticeable that the Abhidhamma version is much more primitive than the version found in the suttas. Okay, and in fact, the Abhidhamma version is probably the most primitive version of the Satipatthana material that we have. We also have. Versions in the Chinese canon, two sutta versions in Chinese. We have, I think, I can't remember now, one or two Abhidhamma versions in Chinese. And we have also a version in the Prajnaparamita Sutta, which is very interesting, okay? Quite unusual, right? So the Mahayana Prajnaparamita Sutta, obviously a much later sutta, but if you read this passage, instead of saying, here a bhikkhu walks out and comes back, it says, here a bodhisattva walks out and comes back. And it's basically exactly the same as the Satipatthana Sutta, it's just put bodhisattva there instead of bhikkhu. Right? So they just cut and pasted a bit from the Satipatthana Sutta and put bodhisattva there instead of bhikkhu. If you look at all of those early sources as a whole, one of the things which is very noticeable is that refrain section at the end of each meditation is very, very different in all of the different versions. Okay, and in most of them it doesn't have anything to do with vipassana. In a couple of them it does, but they are quite differently formed than the one that we have in Pali. So it seems like that was a sort of, there was scope for the different traditions to develop that in their own way. So that's the main reason.
So does that mean that practice of contemplating the three marks of existence doesn't actually belong with samsati? It actually belongs later with samsati?
No, it belongs even later than that. It belongs under, literally under right view of the Eightfold Path. Okay? So the wisdom, right view is the wisdom factor of the Eightfold Path. So that contemplation of impermanence begins as understanding the theory of impermanence, like discussing it and reading it and so on, and then applying in meditation, deepening it, and then finally through realization. But all of which are part of the deepening of the right view of the Eightfold Path.
When you say belongs there, what do you mean by belongs?
Good question. Belongs there. Theravada has had a long history of wanting to classify things. Okay, so you want to make things nice and neat. So you put these things belong with that thing, this thing belongs to that thing. And that's of course fine as far as it goes, although the mind is usually not quite as neat and tidy as that, yeah? So when the Noble Eightfold Path is analysed, there's a number of suttas where it's analysed that the Eightfold Path is divided into three. So there's one section according to what we call Sila Samadhi Panya ethics, Samadhi and wisdom, okay? And so the wisdom section is the first two factors of the Eightfold Path, the ethics section is the next three factors, and the Samadhi section is the last three factors. It's right effort, right mindfulness, and right Samadhi. So that's what I mean when I said it belongs.
Not that it only occurs there.
Well, you know, it kind of
it hangs around.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing with right view, is right view informs the whole path, right? So right view is with all of the other factors of the Eightfold Path and is deepening in that whole practice, right? So even though it's the first factor, it's not as if you, well, first of all, I get my right view and then I'm going to stop doing that and now I'll do my right intention, right? That doesn't quite work like that. But that it's part of that thing. So, you know, certainly these things are always there, right? I mean, it can't not be there, okay? Once you've heard about the truths of impermanence and so on, of course it's going to be there, and of course it will come up in your meditation, and of course when things happen in your meditation, you'll see them through that way, right? And of course you understand your impermanence will deepen, even if you've never heard the word vipassana, right? Right? It can't help but happen. Right? But when we're talking about vipassana in the meditation, what we're talking about is more like specifically doing kinds of meditation whose main purpose is to deepen that understanding of impermanence, okay? Which is how Satipatthana is usually presented. Whereas the perspective I'm trying to offer here is that the main purpose of doing Satipatthana most of the time is for peace of mind, is for samatha.
Would you say liberation? Satipatthana is more the liberation,
the
path was more from
impermanent? Oh, no. Both liberation is the outcome of the path as a whole. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so both samatha and vipassana, actually called in the suttas, called vijja bhagya dhammas. It's called dhammas which have a share in true knowledge or liberation. Okay, so they're both of them helping lead towards liberation. Yeah.
So my understanding, and I can't remember where this comes from, is that there's not really much point doing vipassana or contemplating impermanence in oneself until you've got samadhi.
No, I wouldn't say that.
I can't remember where it came from, but my understanding was that your mind can't really, until it's got a certain level of stillness, there's no discussion. You're not really
going to
get anywhere with it anyway, because it's, I suppose, the amount of delusion
is
zero.
Yeah, I think so. I think that you know, still it's a good practice, and still can be very beneficial. But you just want to be a bit humble about what you expect the outcomes to be. That's all. Yeah. Translation. Yeah. The Pali term there is sachikaroti, which is literally to see with your own eyes. Yeah.
Are you saying you're not tired of most of these sections?
That's right. Yes.
So all the reflective ones about.
But even the words at the front are saying no, even the word, the dramatic no's.
Which passages, sir?
Well, even the weddings often, you know, they clearly know, blah, blah,
right.
Blah, 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 blah. Yeah. It's not just the reflective bit at the end. So the last paragraph seems to be looking for insight knowledge.
That's right, yeah.
So even the word no all the way through. Like, if you know.
Sure.
If you know the free mind,
so it's all about
the free mind and the unfree mind is unfree mind, is that not pretty pretty insightful.
Somewhat. Better than not knowing those things.
So isn't it, is it all balance then or not? I mean, I was just reading that after this.
Okay. Have a look at. Let me see.
This is Papa Jungman, is it?
No, it's actually, he was referring to the contemplation of mind.
Oh, that was one, but it says no senses as well.
I know. Okay, so let's...
I am having a thing called feeling and feelings.
Yeah, sure. Okay, have a look under the section on observing the mind, okay? As you were referring before, the first section there, they clearly, sorry, I don't have page numbers on this, but section 3, they clearly know mind with lust as mind with lust as mind with lust, and mind without lust as mind without lust, okay? Two ways of clearly knowing things, okay? So you're knowing when you have desire in your mind, and you know when you don't have desire in your mind, okay? Then have a look at the next page, okay? And observing the principles. The first one is the five hindrances. Here, monastic or sensual desire. So it's basically the same thing as referred to as lust in the previous one, any kind of desire or whatever. They clearly know I have sensual desire. When they don't have sensual desire, they clearly know I don't have sensual desire, okay? Now that's basically the same as what we've had in the previous version, right? You know your mind with lust, without it, and so on, okay? Next one, then they clearly know how the sensual desire that has not arisen comes to arise, okay? They know how sensual desire that has arisen comes to be abandoned, and they know how the sensual desire comes to not arise again in the future. Okay?
Yes.
So that's understanding causality.
Yeah.
Right? So that's a deeper understanding of the principles which underlies how your mind works. And that's what vipassana is. Just knowing something isn't vipassana.
And you see, those paragraphs that cause that deeper
part of No. In this case, this is in the fourth section, which is in the section on Dhammanupassana, or conduct with the observation of principles, as I put here. And so this is where the practice of vipassana is starting to come forward, in that fourth section.
But you think it's authentically written by Buddha?
Well, I think it's a part of the early text, yeah.
So he is bringing insight into this, and so he is bringing balance in it.
That's right, yeah, that's right.
Sort of taking it towards the center of origination.
Exactly, yeah. At the end of the sutta.
Before,
in the last section. Yeah, sorry. Okay, go on.
I was saying before, the fruit of the practice rather than the actual driver of the practice, in a sense.
It's something which emerges as the practice deepens.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah? Yeah. And you think about what's happening. It's the difference between you do something and then you understand what it is that you're doing. Right? And this is, I mean, it's just, you just step out of the field of meditation and just look at how anything happens in anything, right? If you're cooking pancakes, right? You look at the packet and it says this is how you do it, and you follow the instructions and you do it, and you end up with some reasonable tasting pancakes, and you do that a few times, and the more and more you do that, you begin to figure out, oh yeah, it can't be too hot, the pan can't be too hot, it can't be too cold, you have to do the mix like this, you can't do it like that. And then you understand what you're doing. And then the next time that you're doing it, you can just make pancakes, you don't need to read a recipe or do anything, you just know how to make pancakes because you understand how pancakes work. Okay? So that's how the process of wisdom is emerging in meditation. It's just like making pancakes.
The sort of later additions to the earlier parts of the text, and where you're saying that emphasizing vipassana, I can see what you're saying there, but does that necessarily therefore mean that instead of samatha?
Well, I don't think that was necessarily the intention I think it almost certainly wasn't the intention when the text was originally compiled, but it became used in that way in the 20th century.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you read the Pali Canon as a whole, you know, there's still, you know, so many hundreds of suttas talking about jhanas and things like that, and that's not just the case in the suttas, but even in the classical meditation book in Theravada is the Visuddhimagga,
yeah.
And the whole middle third of the Visuddhimagga is all talking about how to get jhanas.
Yeah.
So it's not as if it was kind of absent from the tradition at all.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? I am.
There's always in that phrase and how the abandoned sensual desire comes to not rise again in the future.
Mm.
This is talking about what arahat?
Yeah. Or anagami technically. Yeah.
So when you understand that, you're talking about you understand the mind of an arahat because you are one?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. I mean, At the highest level of understanding, yes. Okay, any other questions? We're still on the first three words of the sutta. We're doing pretty well, actually. I did a sort of retreat in Jhana Grove earlier in the year with Ajahn Brahmali, and we did the Mahaparinibbana Sutra, and I did the first whole 2-hour class on those three words ever on Mesutan, so we've only been over an hour so far. So. Okay, everyone happy with that? Yeah? Anything you want to... We will go over those themes more as we proceed, so we'll keep on coming back to those ideas. So this is mainly just setting the scene, okay? So let's go on and have a look. We still are actually on the first words of the sutta, and that is to just talk a little bit about the translation. Now, of course, may come as a surprise to you, but the Buddha didn't speak English. I know, amazing, huh? And so he was talking in Pali, or something very like Pali. In fact, I think he probably taught in different dialects as he travelled around the place. But anyway, this text was passed down in the Pali language. And the particular translation was made by me, and this is part of a translation project which I'm working on. I think most of you are familiar in one way or another, but my project after I finish this retreat and a few other things, and I'll be going to Taiwan for about 18 months with the aim of translating the whole of the Pali suttas into English. And when this retreat was coming up, I thought, oh, that's good, I've got some guinea pigs. So you're all my translation guinea pigs, okay? So I thought, well, I'll do a translation of this sutta, so that, you know, we can then read from this and you can give me any feedback, anything which you like or don't like or understand or don't understand. My aim with doing the translation is to try to translate something in simple English, to try to make the meaning as clear as possible. And so I've tried throughout to simplify the vocabulary and to make the syntax, the expressions and the idioms as natural as possible in English. At the same time, it's still a fairly straight translation. It's not like a summarizing translation. It's not like a digested translation or anything like that. It's still pretty much just translating exactly what the Pali text has, but just trying to not make that any more complicated than necessary. So we've already remarked, Nicola remarked, there's one or two terms of phrase that she wasn't familiar with, And so as we go through, I'll be mentioning why I've chosen particular phrases and so on. If you're interested to know how these things have been translated beforehand, of course the most influential translations are those by Venerable Jnanamoli and Bodhi, which is in Middle Length Discourses of the Buddha we have here. Some others of you probably have copies, and you can compare that with the translation I've got here if you're interested. But just generally speaking, I'm quite serious about that. I would really like any feedback that you have about the translation, whether you like it, don't like it, anything you find particularly good or particularly bad. And so remember that the purpose is to try to make something which is as clear as possible. Okay?
So I did it all from scratch?
Yes.
I mean, we use the word observing instead of contemplating.
Yes. Yeah. What do you think of that?
Well, I'm aware of my metaphor that I gave you, the shepherd is too active.
Uh-huh.
You know, herding the sheep rather than observing the sheep, I was thinking about.
Yeah. One of the reasons, okay, so normally it when it talks about, I've used the word observing, and Bhikkhu Bodhi's used contemplating, and a few reasons why I changed that. One is observing is more literal, the Pali is anupassana, which literally means to watch, like sustained observation, sustained watching of something. I asked when I was at Bodhnyana, and I was thinking about this, so there was a group of monks in the room, and I said, what does contemplation mean to the monks? And they all said, basically, the contemplation to them meant thinking reflectively about something. Yeah? Yeah, and so that's what people here think. So, but that's not what anupassana means. Okay? Thinking reflectively about things is something you find in the suttas. There's plenty of places that have that kind of thing where you have, you know, contemplations about particular topics, right? And the Buddha teaches you should contemplate every day that you're subject to birth, aging, and death, and these kinds of things. And it's clearly that's what it means, is to think about something in a reflective way. But that's not what anupassana means. Anupassana means to keep on watching something, keep on watching, keep on watching, keep on watching. Yeah? So that's one reason for using observing. But also the other reason was that observing maybe sounds a little bit more scientific. I mentioned before you have this kind of, you know, this rationalist thing. Well, contemplation is more of sounds more religious. Observation sounds more scientific.
You're biased.
It sounds a bit lighter though, observing. Contemplation seems like really, really in there. Observing to me sounds a little bit sort of like it's a bit not as engaged, not as engaged.
Yes.
Yeah.
A bit gentler, maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you know, a patient is under observation, and you keep your eye on them.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you think Bodhi changed some of the way he translated the words from the Majjhima Nikaya?
Right.
To, I think he's at the Samyutta Nikaya.
And the Anguttara.
For instance, when he was at Satipatthana, his establishment of mindfulness, it's no longer foundations.
Well, the actual reason he changed his mind was because I argue with him about that. And made him change his mind. Yeah.
Yes. That's
right. Yeah. Oh, absolutely, yeah. So just for background for those of you not so familiar, but the Bhikkhu Bodhi is an American monk who's done most of the translations that we use today, and he's still active today, even though his health is very poor, but his first major translation was this one, the Middle Length Discourses of the Buddha, which is in fact an adapted translation from a handwritten manuscript made in the late 1950s by a monk called Jnanamoli, who was at that time living in Sri Lanka. Jnanamoli was a very extraordinary monk who was only a monk for about 10 or 11 years, and then he died, and during that time he translated extremely accurately and thoroughly a very large number of often extremely complex and obscure texts from Pali. He's quite an extraordinary scholar. But he left a lot of them in just like small handwritten pencil notebooks with lots of crossings out and experiments with different kind of renderings and going back and fixing things and so on. And those manuscripts originally tidied up and published by the monk who used to live at Wat Buddha Dhamma, Prakantipalo, who published that edition called In the Buddha's Words in the 1970s. And that was an extract of set 90 of his Majjhima Nikaya suttas. Just as a sort of side note for those of you, many of you will be familiar with Venerable Kandipala, who later disrobed, and he's now very unwell. He's suffering from dementia. He's being looked after by some of his students in Melbourne, and one of the jobs that I've actually just finished, literally just yesterday morning before I came here, was editing and finishing off the last book of Kandipala. So before, as he was succumbing to his dementia, he was working on a translation of another Pali book, the Sutta Nipata, which is a very beautiful collection of early Buddhist poems. And he was carrying this manuscript around with him and sort of making adjustments and things, again, just all sort of handwritten. But then he sort of slipped further and further into dementia and was unable to finish the text. So some of his students got hold of it, they digitized it, and then they sent it to me, and there's about 85% of the translations were done. So I finished off the translations, edited it, and so on and so forth. And that is ready, and hopefully we'll have, if any of you are coming to my going away party at the Woods Library on, what is it, Sunday week, I'm hoping that we'll have some printed editions of it there to have a look at. But anyway, so that was just something that, you know, for me was quite a nice thing to be able to do out of respect for Kandipala and his contribution to Australian Buddhism. So we're trying to see if we can get the printed edition to him before he dies, so he can hold it in his hands. Yeah. Anyway, so that was the backstory. So Kandipala had edited 90 of these Majjhima Nikaya suttas, and Bhikkhu Bodhi took up the project of doing the whole collection, and he used Kandipala's edited ones as the basis and also Nyanamoli's handwritten manuscript, and then he came up with the middle length discourses of the Buddha in the early 90s. Subsequently, he started the next Nikaya, the Sanyutta Nikaya, which he published as the connected discourses, and then the numerical discourses, Anguttara Nikaya. And of course, during that whole period, I mean, that's spanning like nearly three decades now, obviously his own translation style has evolved, and different kinds of renderings he's kind of gone back and forth on over that period of time. Yeah.
I thought principles was really helpful.
Okay.
And so, it's such a good idea, why not come up with it before, actually?
Yeah. Yeah, that actually, oh, thank you, that translation was, that's based on a suggestion by the scholar A.K. Warder, who was one of the great scholars of Buddhism as a whole, and he did a long, very detailed study of the Dhamma, the word, Pali word is Dhamma, and he was one who suggested that in many cases that principles is a good translation. Yeah. Good. Okay. Okay, let's go. Shall we see if we can make it to the end of the first paragraph? What do you reckon? Let's be adventurous. Maybe even the second paragraph if we're doing well. Okay, one time the Buddha was staying in the land of the Kurus, where they have a city called Kamasadama. There the Buddha addressed the monastics. Monastics, venerable sir, they replied, and the Buddha said this. Okay, so just a couple of notes, I won't go into too much detail on this, but the Kuru country is very famous in Indian literature. The Kurukshetra is where the war of the Bhagavad Gita and Mahabharata was held. And so the Kurukshetra is one of the most famous locations in all of Indian mythology, and it's located around modern-day Delhi. Okay, so it's somewhat out of the way for the Buddha. He normally didn't get that far to the north and west. It's a little bit unusual, and there are various commentarial stories as to why this particular sutra is located there, but nothing, I think, of particular interest. So I won't go into that. Any questions on Kamasa Dhamma? Anything? It appears in a couple of sutras elsewhere, but not all that common. There the Buddha addressed the monastics. So here I'm using the word monastic instead of bhikkhu, and we discussed this a little bit earlier. Most of the Buddhist suttas are addressed to the monks, okay? And so it says bhikkhus, bhikkhave. It's one of the most commonly found words in the whole of the Pali Canon is bhikkhave. And of course it's a bit unfortunate that the suttas are very sort of gender biased, right? And Pali has a very strong strong tendency to favour the masculine gender. It's always the default gender when talking about people, and it's also even in talking about like inanimate things and animals and so on, it's always by far the most common gender, so kind of there's a strong tendency to default to the masculine gender. However, there are a number of contexts where in the suttas it's clear that who's being addressed in the sutra is not just monks, okay? And that in the audience was monks, nuns, often laymen and laywomen as well. And there are a number of times where it's shown that there's an idiom in the Pali where a group is addressed by referring to one member of that group. I'll give an example of what I mean. There's a sutta called the Chula Gosinga Sutta where there are three monks, Anuruddha, Kimbila and Nandiya. And the Buddha is talking to them, but when he addresses them as Anuruddhas, in the plural, okay? So he addresses, even though there's three monks with different names, he addresses them all by one name, who presumably was the senior monk, and calls them the Anuruddhas. So this is just like a sort of colloquial idiom in the Pali language, that's how you did things. So when expressing it as bhikkhus, it wasn't meaning to imply that the bhikkhunis and lay people were absent. So this was something which was discussed by myself based on a paper, some discussion between myself, Venerable Analio, and Venerable Ananda Jyoti late last year. And I was sort of seemed to sort of agree that it's not merely more inclusive to translate it in a gender-neutral way, it's actually more accurate as well. The Pali wasn't meant to be exclusive in that way. In fact, one of the versions of the Satipatthana Sutta in Chinese says it is addressed to bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, so that's actually explicitly mentioned. And somebody said earlier that the commentary says that actually bhikkhus just means any practitioner here, so we should address it to practitioners instead of to monastics. Yeah, maybe. That's a kind of a bridge further, you know. That's like I'm not sure if I'm willing to take that step or not. What do you think? Is that a good idea?
Yeah.
Yeah, but you're biased.
Some people are already doing it on a very regular basis.
Uh huh.
Using a practitioner.
Yeah.
So you would be the first to pray.
Yeah.
In the West Indies, you're just Goldstein, for example.
Yeah, so I'm asking the States quite strong on this. A lot of his talks where he sort of goes into this, but I've listened to, he makes the point of saying means anybody on the path. Actually, that's one of his translations, not just practitioner, anybody on the path. So, of course, you could go into what you consider anybody on the path to be. But his term is deliberate, very inclusive, and I think that's because he knows he's got quite a broad.
Of course, yeah.
And he doesn't want anybody to feel shut out by all this sort of technical stuff that, in many cases, is only going to apply to monastics. There's a limit to what you can do in that life.
Yeah.
Did you call it? Because it's kind of set in the context of where he said it and who said it. He said it just to monastics. I'm just reading this paragraph because he was in that place talking to a bunch of monastics.
Yeah, which may have been the case or it may not have been.
Oh, it may not be the case.
Yeah. I mean, if the Buddha was addressing an audience specifically of lay people, then he would address them as such. But I think if he was addressing a general audience, which would include the people from the different communities, then he would probably just use the word bhikkhu or bhikkhave as a convention. Or at least the texts just have that. Whether the Buddha himself said that is another matter. Yeah.
You'd have to be accurate. If it's a historical context, you'd have to be accurate.
If you can infer from the context, then yes, sometimes you can do that, but very often you can't. So in this particular case, we don't have any indication apart from that. That's the only thing we've got.
So in this case, we've only got the name of the city. So in some of the other sources, you've got that an art of Indicus Park or Justice Park,
right,
or whatever.
Right.
So there are some locations where it's more likely just to be monastics because it was the place maybe where they were, the rents, whatever. Here in the city, it could be a community centre.
Whatever, so there's no sort of clue in there. That's true, yeah. So you haven't even got the context. So the fact that it's just the city being mentioned doesn't really give you any clue. Yeah, that's just true. Yeah, the other thing to bear in mind is that there's a strong tendency in the Pali text towards normalization. And this is something which is sort of understood within text critical studies generally, but basically it's the idea that editors tend to normalize things. Okay? So for example, when Tolkien published The Lord of the Rings, he spelt elves with a V, and then his publisher said, no, it doesn't have an F in there, elves. And he hated elves. Right? And so he had to sort of trying to get them to keep the V there, which is actually more archaic form of English. Yeah? So the same thing you find always, all manuscript traditions and all textual traditions. So in this case, bhikkhave is actually a very interesting word because it's not actually Pali as such, right? It's actually Magadhan or something like Magadhan. The standard Pali form would be bhikkhavo, which you find in some places, but most commonly in suttas you always find bhikkhave. So then the question is, why is this a very rare occasion when the Magadhan, the Eastern form, has been preserved in a Western dialect? Yeah? My suspicion is because it was very closely associated with the voice of the Buddha. It's probably in the accent that the Buddha used and became so closely, you know, used so many times right throughout the suttas that it resisted that change to be standardized to be bhikkhavo.
I'm also going to be saying sometime back that an indigo path is like a report.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, so this is probably.
So that's another aspect of the standardization, yeah. Yeah. So if we don't know where something was, then they just say it was at Sarvati and at Bindika's Park, yeah. And the same thing with the address, if they didn't know who it was addressed to, they probably just put in their bhikkhus because that was the standard thing.
And that's about
yeah.
So that bhikkhus is similar to right now, when you refer to bhikkhus in a monastery? No.
It just means staying. Yes. Staying among the kurus. Yes. Yeah. Yep. Okay. So anyway, so I've used monastics here. It's a little bit not entirely happy with it, but we'll see how we go. Venerable Sir clarified and the Buddha said this. Monastics, this is the path where all things come together as one, to purify sentient beings, to make an end of pain and sadness, to get past sorrow and lamentation, to reach the way, to witness Nibbana, that is the four kinds of mindfulness meditation. Okay, so here are a few things that need some explanation, so I've called it the path where all things come together as one, and Pali is Ekayana Maggo, Ekayana Ayambikave Maggo. Often translated as the only way or the direct way and so on and so forth. I did a long study of that particular word in the history of mindfulness, which is very, very interesting. Do you want to hear all the details or not? Very official version, that's what it means. And anybody else is wrong. Yeah. It's actually a Brahmanical term. And it's one of these cases, any case in the Buddhist tradition where there are ideas which were derived from language was used in Brahmanical texts, and they were used in the Buddhist texts, and the later generations of Buddhists weren't familiar with the Brahmanical texts, so they forgot what the context was. And so in the traditions, they invent all these different kinds of meanings for this term, but in fact it has a very clear, very strong meaning as found in the Brahmanical texts. To say that it's from the Brahmanical text in this case is not just making stuff up, but in fact the phrase Ekaya Namage is put into the mouth of Brahma. Okay, in the Sagatavada, it's actually Brahma who comes to the Buddha and says, this Satipatthana is an Ekaya Namage. Okay? So it's literally put into the mouth of Brahma. Okay? And so in the Brahmanical texts, Ekayana is used very, very powerfully in one of the most important of all of the Brahmanical passages, okay? And I can't emphasize this enough. This is the short version, by the way. I can't emphasize this enough. When we talk about the Brahmanical tradition, okay, you've got a mass of different texts and things like that. But like in the Buddhist tradition, a lot of those texts didn't really matter, right? Nobody read them very much. Nobody paid any attention to them. They weren't very influential, okay? But they're, of all of those texts, especially the pre-Buddhist texts, the single most important one from a philosophical point of view is the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Far more important than any other text. And in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, by far the most important teacher is a teacher called Yajnavalkya, who lived in the same region the Buddha did about 200 years before the Buddha. And of all Yajnavalkya's dialogues, by far the most important is one particular dialogue which he had with his wife Maitreyi. And that particular dialogue has very close and intimate connections and many, many points with Buddhist scriptures. Okay? It was clearly well known to the Buddha or to whoever was compiling the text. And there are many, many examples of imagery, ideas, similes, and so on, which are closely connected from this particular dialogue, right? Not any others. There's no other dialogue that has such close connections. This particular one. And in this particular dialogue has Yajnavalkya talking to his wife Maitreyi, and he comes to Maitreyi and he says, my beloved, I want to come and talk to you because I'm going to renounce, I'm going to leave home. Okay? This is incredibly important in the Brahmanical tradition. The Brahmanical tradition is not a renunciate tradition. It's the tradition of people staying at home and worshipping the gods and ensuring the prosperity and stability of the family, okay? So for Yajnavalkya to come along and say, I'm going to leave home and be a renunciate, is a radical shift. That's why this is such an important dialogue, okay? And he says, I want to explain this to you because you have the wisdom that you can understand what it is that I'm talking about. And he says, he goes through this whole kind of dialogue. It's not for the sake of one's wife that the wife is dear. It's not for the sake of one's wealth that one's wealth is dear. It's not for the sake of your home or your children or any of these things that those things are dear. But it's for the sake of the self that all of those things are dear. Okay? All of those things come back to the self. Okay? And then he goes on this long passage talking about how everything comes back to one place. Yeah? All of the sights all converge on the eye, all of the sounds all converge on the ear, all of the words converge in the Vedas, and on and on and on he goes, many, many examples. And the word he uses there is ekayana, the same word we find in Satipatthana Sutta. And it clearly means that place where everything comes together as one. Okay, all sights come together in the eye, all of the sounds come together in the ear, and so on and so forth. And that's a very powerful passage that he uses, and that's leading up to his great revelation, which was the great insight which Yajnavalkya had in the Brahmanical tradition, where he said that all of these things which are the self are, and the phrase he uses is vijnana gahameva, a sheer mass of consciousness. Okay? And so this is where that idea that we're very familiar with in the non-dual traditions of the small self and the big self, tadpongasi, again, this is Yajnavalkya's phrase. And so this is so pivotal and so important in the whole Indian tradition. And so the Buddha was adopting this language, the Ekayana, and as always, using it in his own way. So obviously he was not using it with the metaphysical overtones of talking about itself, but he was using it in a practical and psychological way, saying this is where everything comes together as one. The word one in Buddhist meditation always means samadhi, okay? Always means samadhi. Constantly throughout the text it uses this phrase, again, a Brahmanical use in the Upanishads. It says, eki bhavati na pashyati. He becomes one, he does not see. He becomes one, he does not hear. He becomes one, he does not smell. And so it's this unification of mind. So the explanation of this is actually offered in one of the Chinese translations of the Satipatthana Sutta, and this is a translation found in the Ekotrika Agama, in the Chinese translation, and it says, literally it says that it's called the Ekayana Magga, the Ekayana path, because it leads to unification of mind. Okay, it leads to samadhi. That's why it's called the Ekayana Magga. Okay, so this is why my translation is here, is where all things come together as one. Okay, so when you're practicing, you begin your practice, and we know that when we begin to practice, our practice is characterized by diversity. There are many things, right? So many things. And you sit down to meditate, and so many thinking and hearing and all of these kinds of things, many, many things going on. And as the further you go into meditation, the more your mind becomes unified, the more your mind becomes settled, and the more everything comes together as one. That's what the Ekayana Magga means. Okay.
When I read that, all things, you know, I had a bit of resistance because things are so mundane.
Right.
And I was thinking, you know, you're like just now you said it many different ways, like all converge on the eye or unification of mind, they're sort of a lot more lofty. But then if you just read it like that, your mind doesn't stutter on it, you don't even stay with it. All things come together as one, it's pretty simple.
Right.
That's actually probably a useful thing because then people aren't going to over interpret it.
Right.
If you have no unification of mind or convergence on the eye, you know, people start to interpret that based on their own experience.
Yeah.
Because they've got, you know, it just leads to a lot of confusion sometimes.
In the history of mindfulness, they use convergence for that, and I think convergence is you know, it's a good translation, but I felt that it was just a little bit more. Yeah, like you say, maybe a little bit too lofty or a bit less clear exactly what it was talking about. Yeah.
Did you aim at emphasizing kind of a mundane or a very grasp in reach?
Yeah. Make it as plain as possible.
Because samadhi is a lofty state.
It is. Yeah. Sorry, yeah.
Can I clarify? So what you're referring to in all things is basically sort of the methodology for developing the mind and unifying the mind. You're not talking about all the teachings or anything like that, you're just talking about mental training in itself.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you say that in the Pedagogic tradition, the leading hole is not
It wasn't part of the old Brahmanic Vedic tradition at all.
I don't remember, you know, the four stages they talk about, and I thought
it was
also Anupadaka Macharya and
Lhasa Nipanyasa. Yeah, that all came up later. That's much later. That's not even in the time of the Buddha, that hadn't been developed. Yeah. So what the Vedic tradition is entirely a worldly tradition. Okay, so the Vedas, there's nothing about renunciation or anything like that throughout the Vedas. It's all about fertility, riches, winning your battles, getting all of the good stuff, having lots of kids, this kind of thing. And so that in that time before the Buddha, 100, 200 years before the Buddha, you started to get these renunciate ideas coming into the Brahmanical tradition. probably by influence with the other local traditions, what we call the Shramana traditions, which are around that area, the Bihar, the Greater Magadha area at the time. So they sort of came into contact, and so it's like it's an evolving and changing tradition, as all traditions are. Yeah. So in the time of the Buddha, you do find sort of renunciate Brahmins, but still you find, you know, there's even down till today, you know, the majority of Brahmins are still living in a household life.
I'm still a bit confused as to what things refers to.
I don't refer to anything.
Because in the grammatical sense, it's all sense experience. Right. And in the Buddhist sense, the samadhi is sort of defined by an essence, which means experiences that go. So it's the unification of mind. So
yeah.
The things of the mind, or...
The word things is the least important part of that definition, and you could leave it out and it wouldn't matter.
Right.
Yeah? But it's just convenient for expression to put it in there. I'm just wondering whether it's maybe it should be phrased another way. I'm not sure what a better way of doing it would be. When I did it in History of Mindfulness, I said something like, it's the path to convergence.
I think I don't get a sense that it's the unification of mind from that sentence. When I think of things, I think of sense experiences, which to me is more of the grammatical sense. Of all the sense experiences converging on mind. Yeah.
This is in the context of meditation, though.
Yeah.
So there's no reference to anything else. But...
Okay, we'll bear that in mind as we go on and see how.
Can you consider it like a recipe for a cupcake, but it feels more like a recipe for an omelette?
Sad. I see you penetrated to the deep wisdom.
Yeah, maybe I'm too simple, but I'm seeing the reality stuff.
As what, sir?
So a bit of the, you mix a bit of the yarns with a bit of the insight, and you get a little, you realise all this variety of the causality stuff. Dependent origination. Is that too limited in interpretation of it?
No, that's fine.
It seems to have all that. And the fact of every paragraph, all ending is wrong again, for noble truths.
And I'm still not quite sure where the omelette's repeating in.
Oh, it's just a recipe, isn't it? Is it a fast cup?
You have to break a few eggs, sorry. Go on.
You've got all the different stuff and then
topic of over-interpretation of metaphor. But I mean, it is interesting. You can see how this sort of becomes a thing. You know, I mean, I'm sure the Buddha went through this many times. He's like, it's just metaphor. And like, oh, but there must be. No, it's just something I thought of at the time. You know? So we have another question.
We seem to be concentrating on the form rather than the content, and that if that continues for 7 days, we may only reach the end of the book.
We may, yeah.
And I think that would be a shame because it's actually beautiful as it goes on.
Okay, yeah. No, I think we probably will accelerate a little bit as we go. Yes. I would hope so. Yeah. Okay, so then, okay, so part of all things come together as one. The next phrases are, I think, fairly straightforward. They're basically all just synonyms for basically that's the purpose that we're practicing, to, you know, purify the mind and suffering and so on and so forth. And then finally, I've translated Satipatthana as the four kinds of mindfulness meditation. Again, just striving for a very sort of direct translation, trying to say, well, what does it mean? If I was trying to talk to somebody who wasn't a Buddhist and say, what is it that we're doing? Well, we're talking about different kinds of mindfulness meditation. That's how I'd say it. I wouldn't say we're talking about different establishments of mindfulness. What does that mean? So, so the term itself, Satipatthana, again, is one of these terms which tends to get overinterpreted quite a lot. My reading of it is that Satipatthana essentially just means mindfulness or mindfulness meditation, and we translate it literally as foundations or establishments of mindfulness. Previously, it was translated incorrectly as foundations of mindfulness, which is actually based on a misreading of the Pali. There's a very common idiom in Pali where a verb is repeated with either itself or with a synonym. Okay? So you might say, you say the same word twice, and this in fact happens often throughout the sutta where we talk about, I'm just thinking of an example in the sutta where it has, so for example, in all the section on feelings, actually the literal translation is when he feels a painful feeling. Okay, so you repeat the noun and the verb together, you feel a painful feeling. But you don't really say that in English, do you? You never say, I feel a painful feeling, you say, I have a painful feeling. That's the idiom we use in English. So similar with this idiom here, that sati and upatthana actually are just synonyms, right? They basically mean just the same thing. And when you put them together as a compound, you're not really saying anything different. You're basically just saying, this is what the practice of mindfulness is. And so sometimes, again, we have this tendency to overinterpret things because we read it too literally. We don't really read it as the idiom was meant. But actually what it means is just, you know, this is how you do meditation, right? Different kinds of mindfulness meditation. Okay? And so far we've talked for 3 hours and we haven't yet discussed what actual mindfulness means. Maybe.
I find that word a little bit archaic. I've never personally resonated much with mindfulness. Did you consider other translations?
Such as?
Recollection or... Because I know it was an English scholar who translated that.
Right, it was T.W.E. Stevens who originated. Yeah. That's pretty much taken over the world by now.
Yeah.
you can't escape mindfulness.
I wonder if someone outside of Lisbon would know what being mindful is.
I know, it's an incredibly widespread word these days.
Yeah, there's a cafe, which is slogan,
it's
mindfully.
Well, that's right, and that's that kind of modernization project which I was talking about earlier. You know, they've done it quite consciously. Yeah. I mean, one of the things about that is that the process of secularizing, okay, so secularizing the teachings, taking them out of a religious context, is exactly what the Buddha did. Right? I mean, the Buddha was the first great secularist of Buddhism, and that's exactly what he's doing with things like this phrase, ekayana, right? He's taking it out of a metaphysical, mystical, religious context and applying it in a straightforward, psychological, realistic context. And that's what he did all the way through. So the Buddha was the first great secular Buddhist.
I have a key book at home which has a definition which I like, which is monkey says to Kanga, oh, so it means your mind is full of, you know, whatever the object is.
Is that what the monkey says to Panda? It's full of, like, whatever the object is.
So, Panda's explaining what open is to monkey.
Yeah.
And monkey gets it and he's like, oh, that means, so he's saying, when you're walking, you're just walking.
Mm.
So your mind is full of,
okay,
you know, whatever that they refer to. Like, full of it, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Remembering to maintain the focus on an object of observation.
Okay, that's pretty good. Yeah. I like all of that except for the object bit.
The object bit, yeah, I thought, yeah.
Yeah. There's no word in early Buddhism for object, which is interesting, yeah? In the sense like an object of the mind.
As an act of word separation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Contents.
Something like that, contents or
contention.
Phenomena? Sorry?
Teaching. Remember the teaching.
One meaning in mindfulness to remember the teaching? Yeah.
Being in the present.
Sorry?
Being in the present.
Being in the present, yeah. I'll tell you what, we've been here for 2 hours already, so that's probably enough for this session. Why don't I talk about that, and we'll have a Dhamma talk this evening, and I'll talk more about the topic of just mindfulness itself in the talk this evening. Does that sound like a good idea? Okay, so that will be at 7 o'clock. The topic was, someone raised a question yesterday about whether, if you forgot when we were discussing, we've got to mention the idea of having any guided meditations. Mm-hmm. So the question was asked, do we want to have any guided meditations? Do you think, is that a good idea?
Yes.
Yes? Kate's shaking her head, no. Don't be afraid to say no.
Would you afraid to disagree? That's
obviously outlandish. No, who's in the nay camp? Who doesn't want mindfulness meditations? Yes, brave souls.
I would not
yeah. A body one. Yeah. Okay. Well, look. How about this? We can begin at 7 o'clock with a guided meditation for about half an hour. And those of you who don't want to do the guided meditations can come in at 7:30. Okay. This evening, if you don't like to do it, that's fine. You can go out and, you know, meditate by yourself or whatever. Does it sound reasonable?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we do just a little bit of guided meditation each day, just to sort of come back more. But like I said yesterday, you know, when we're doing the sutta classes, then things can get a bit more theoretical, a bit more abstract, and so on. And, you know, remember, it's never meant to stay there, it's meant to start there, okay? One thing which I've noticed in teaching the suttas and teaching Dhamma over many years is that, and something which I think is good to remember as a caution, is not to be in too much of a rush to interpret things, and not to be in too much of a rush to apply things in a practical sense. Okay? What often happens is we read things, we read sutras, and we say, oh, you know, how does that apply for me, or how is that relevant for me, right? But that's just an assumption. Maybe it's not relevant for you. Right? How do you know it's relevant? That's just, you know, until you practice, you don't know whether it's relevant. Maybe it's talking at a much higher level of practice than you've ever realized. Yeah? Maybe it's talking about something which was meant for a completely different kind of person or different kind of problem than the problems you're dealing with. Okay? So if we assume that something's going to be relevant for us, we just immediately start twisting the text to become something which applies to our own limited understanding of our own situation. Okay? So when we're reading suttas and we're reading texts, we start out, again, we start, we don't finish, but we start out by just treating the text as a text. Okay? What does it mean? What's it talking about? What kind of thing is it trying to say? Okay? And you give that its due, you spend some time with the text, trying to understand it, figure out exactly what is it talking about. And then you let that settle down. You let your understanding of that grow, and you try to understand what did it mean for those people in that place at that time. Okay? And when you've done that for a while and you think you've got a good handle on that, you can gradually start to ask the question, you know, might this be applicable to what's happening for me? And then you can maybe start to say, oh, actually, well, this bit maybe, you know, that seems quite relevant for what's happening in my meditation. This bit, not really sure about, so I might just leave that bit aside for now. Yeah? And so don't be kind of desperate to sort of, you know, insist that everything must be relevant. It's not. Not everything is relevant to you all the time. And we don't know what's relevant and what's not relevant until we've taken the time to really just sort of sit with the text and just give it its due. So what we'll be doing during this retreat is during the sutta classes, it'll be just a bit more talking about what is the actual text, what is the words going on there, and by itself, that will be a little bit dry, a little bit abstract, a little bit theoretical, okay? But we give that its due, we spend some time doing that, and then through the meditations and the talks and things, we'll gradually be learning to apply and see what's going to be relevant in our practice, okay?